You know, when I was a Boy Scout years ago, I learned to make a fire. I guess anything was more exciting or thrilling to know that I had the power within me to make a fire. And I'm not talking about a Stephen King fire starter. I'm talking about real fire. And that I had the ability to do that. They taught me how to do that. I still know how to do it. And it was a very simple process. Girls didn't learn this back then. Girls stayed home. And we real men went out and made fires. Which was kind of exciting because we would, you get a stick, a pointed stick, dry stick, and a board that has a notched hole in it. And then you have a bow that has a loose string on it, and you wrap that around the stick, and then you hold the stick with a little knob on the end of it, and you slide that bow back and forth, and it spins the stick and causes friction in that hole. And then you take something like this. This is the stuff off the side of a cabbage palm tree. Cleaning people hate it when I bring stuff like this into church. This is great stuff. They don't have this up north. And you can kind of crumble it up and it makes all kinds of good dust. And it's very, very dry and it's like flax or tinder. And then you place that around the stick that's spinning in that hole. And as the stick gets hot, it gets this stuff hot. And it catches fire very easily and it begins to glow. And then you take it like this and you blow on it, just gently. And as you blow on it, why, that little glowing spark bursts into flame. And then you take it over and you have your other sticks on the ground and you put it underneath there and pretty soon you have a fire. And you cook your supper on it. And then after supper, why, you sit around with the guys. Tell tales about days of yore, long into the night, and then you crawl into your sleeping bag and you watch the glowing embers as the logs break apart and send their sparks up. You go to sleep, that fire still crackling and dying. That's fire. That's the way you make it. It's kind of exciting that it's made that way. Ralph Mull, who's here this morning, Ralph is one of our elders. Ralph used to be the fire chief here in South Brevard. Ralph was the guy who taught me, says, you know, there's three things that you need to have a fire. You need to have fuel. That's what this is. This is fuel. Doesn't last very long, so you add more fuel to it. You need to have fuel, and you need to have heat, enough heat to make this burst into flame, and then you need to have oxygen. Those three things. And of course, if you want to put out a fire, why, you can withdraw any one of those three elements and the fire goes out. You can put water on it and that cools it down, the heat goes away, or you can cover it with foam and that keeps the oxygen from getting to it, or you can just simply take the fuel away, cut off the fuel supply, and the fire goes out. That's what you essentially do when you turn the ignition off in your automobile. You cut off the fuel supply. The fire goes out in your engine. And if you want to have a fire, you add those three elements. You put them all three together, and you've got fire. Now, that's what Jesus does for us. And I want to talk to you a little bit about that this morning. You know, my job in being with you is to tell you who God is. Now, there's other churches that you can go to if you need other things in your life, and they'll not only tell you who God is, but they'll tell you how to act. God has not told me to tell you how to act. In fact, I have found out that if I tell you how to act, it's usually that you should act like I act. And since I act wrong most of the time, why, then you begin to act wrong. So I have stopped telling people how to act. I've stopped telling people what to do. I don't have a commission on my life to tell you how to act, or what to do, or how to behave. My commission in life is to tell you who God is. My commission is to bring God to you, either through myself or through others around me, or to bring you into the presence of God. And then I have found that if I do that, God tells you how to act. God tells you how to behave. God tells you what to do. And he does it a lot better than I do. And we really become priests in the kingdom of God, where every man hears God for himself. And I think that's exciting. I think that's what the church ought to be, rather than a group of people who all sit there and you get whipped and beat over the head with a rule book. And what we want to do is to bring you into the presence of God. As you come into the presence of God, then you hear God, and God tells you how to act. So I want to talk to you a little bit about this morning about who God is and what he does, what is how he operates. And that's the reason I wanted to talk to you about fire, because that's essentially what Jesus does for us, is he takes us as dry sticks, this kind of stuff. This is what we look like. The Bible says that our righteousness is to God this kind of stuff. In fact, it says it's filthy rags. Virtually worthless, nothing beautiful to look at. That's who we are, as far as our righteousness is before God. And God takes us like this, as kind of dry sticks, and then he, through a process called friction, which I'll not describe this morning, which most of you have already experienced, but through a process called friction, conflict, tribulation. Anybody here experience tribulation this morning? Well, that's the rubbing of the sticks together. Through the process of tribulation, there's heat. And then, taking the tinder or the fuel of our lives and the tribulation of the circumstances, Jesus comes and blows his Holy Spirit upon us. Just gently like that. And that spark becomes fire. And that fire is creative. That fire is the thing that we cook on and the thing that we warm our hands with and the thing that draws others around us for fellowship, and we sit and tell tales long into the night. Now, Matthew talks about that in the 12th chapter of his book. Matthew is one of the biographers of Jesus. And in Matthew 12, he's told a story about something that Jesus did which upset the religious people of the day. The religious people of the day were rule makers. They were lawgivers. In fact, they even called them that. They called them scribes and lawyers. A lawyer, of course, as you know, or I hope you know, in the Bible, is not an attorney. A lawyer is a person who has studied the law and then will quote the law back to you and tell you how to act and how to behave and what to do. And so it was the scribes and the lawyers that Jesus really gave a hard time to, and he's given them a hard time to these fellows. Because he went out on the Sabbath, and the law said that you shouldn't do anything on the Sabbath, and he saw a need. There was a man with a shriveled hand, and Jesus touched him and healed that man. And then the religious people, all the church folks, got upset about that. Because, see, they had the whole thing backwards. They thought that the reason for the Sabbath was so you could serve the Sabbath. They didn't understand that the Sabbath was there to serve you, that the reason for the Sabbath is so that you can rest and be relaxed, be refreshed to go to work the next day. And they had turned the whole thing backwards and turned it into a law, and if anybody broke the Sabbath, then they got stoned or killed or run out of town or whatever else. Well, Jesus had broken the Sabbath, and they were all upset about it. And in the midst of this, after Matthew tells this story, then he has this little kind of parentheses and aside, and he says, you know, you have to understand who Jesus was and why he acts the way he does. So pick it up with verse 15. Aware of this, that the Pharisees had gone out and plotted how they would kill him, aware of this, Jesus withdrew from that place, and many followed him, and he healed all their sick. He started on the Sabbath. What he started on the Sabbath, he kept going. On Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, he healed their sick, warning them not to tell who he was. Jesus was not a horn tutor. I don't know if you've ever realized this about Jesus. Jesus didn't have cards printed that said, Jesus Christ, healer, evangelist, prophet, miracle worker. He didn't have that, didn't take out ads in the Jerusalem Post. He didn't do any of those things. In fact, he healed people and then told them not to tell anybody. Of course, they did. But he was not a publicist in any way. He didn't have an agent, didn't have a public relations director. Now, all of this was to fulfill, says Matthew, what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah, "Here is my servant whom I am chosen." Now, this is what God had to say about Jesus 750 years before he was born. "Here is my servant whom I have chosen, the one I love, in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him, and he will proclaim justice to the nations. He will not quarrel or cry out." He's not a Baptist or a Pentecostal. "He will not quarrel or cry out. No one will hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out till he leads justice to victory. In his name the nations will put their hope." A smoldering wick he will not snuff out. This is a smoldering wick. If I were to set it on fire, and unfortunately I do not have my sticks to set it on fire, and of course real men don't use matches, and no self-respecting woodsman would ever go into the woods with a cigarette lighter, so you have to do this with sticks, and I don't have the time to do that this morning, but just take my word for it that it can be done. And after it begins to smolder, he will not put it out. Now, a bruised reed he will not break. I think the best translation I know of that is, "Jesus won't kick a man when he's down." That's the best way I know to translate that. Jesus won't kick a man when he's down. He'll not take a guy who's hurting and lecture him. Ever been into a doctor's office? You came in with your arm broken, and the doctor said, "Well, why'd you do that? You know, that was a foolish thing. What were you doing up in that tree anyway?" And you're sitting there and blood's running down your arm and your bones sticking out. And you, "Listen, I don't need somebody to ask me questions like that. I just want somebody to fix my arm, please." Jesus was an arm fixer. "A bruised reed I will not break. A smoldering wick he will not snuff out." Jesus looks at the slightest spark of hope in the midst of a smoldering wick, and he blows on it gently. He doesn't stomp it out. He doesn't throw it on the floor and says, "That's just a spark. I only deal with fires. I don't deal with little sparks." No. Jesus looks into your life, and I'm here this morning to tell you what Jesus is like. Jesus looks into your life, and he looks for that spark, wherever it is. And there is a spark in every life. In every one of you this morning, there's some kind of spark burning. There's the fire of God. It may be covered up with guilt. It may be covered up with sin. It may be covered up with all of a life full of mistakes and laziness and atrophy and all kinds of junk. But there is a fire burning in the life of every person on earth. And Jesus is here to find that fire and to blow his Holy Spirit upon. And he blows it and it bursts into flame. Now, that's what Jesus has done. Now, religious people don't do that. Religious people walk around and find fires and stomp on them. They look for bruised reeds and they break them because they only want the whole. They don't want that which is bruised or that which is only smoldering. Now, it's hard for us to understand how Jesus respects people as people. I don't know whether you've understood that. But Jesus respects people as people. Now, the reason for this is because of the Western society, the culture in which we live. And every once in a while, I feel like I'm taking on the whole Western society. But we have been trained in a school society that grades people. Our whole educational concept in the West, you go to school, now you don't start at 6, you start at 3. And they start with a very tender mind, and the first thing they do to you when you go to school is they grade you. They test you, and they grade you. and they grade you on the basis of performance and ability and behavior. Those are the three things that you're graded on. And the grade spells the difference between whether you're a success or a failure in school. And this is planted in you. It's planted in every one of us. And so first of all, we begin judging other people on the basis of their ability or their performance or their behavior. If they perform differently from we do, we give them a poor grade because we set the standards up. If their abilities are less than us. And so a guy walks in and he doesn't have as many marbles as you do. And you count his marbles. We're marble counters. And on the basis of whether he has at least 100 marbles, which is where the IQ kind of thing kind of breaks open, if he's under 100 marbles, why, we put him over here in this category. And we put him in a little box with bars on it. And you say, you stay there because you're not worth as much as the rest of us who have 110 marbles. And I say to you, it's sin. God does not treat us that way. But the society treats us that way. And what we have done is we have taken that kind of thing and we've carried that over into our spiritual life. Now, I understand, and Dr. Norris, Dean Norris, caught me after the first service this morning, and I talked about this a little bit. He says, do you know what this is at FIT, what this week is? And I said, no. He says, it's exam week. He says, we're getting ready to grade everybody at FIT. And I said, how do you feel like it? He says, I hate it. But you're in a system. And the only thing you can do in the system is to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. You do the best you can. But the thing does not have to affect you. It does not have to affect you in the way you treat other people or in the way you treat yourself. Grades do not spell the difference in the spiritual life between success and failure. God does not grade us. God does not grade us on that basis, on how we perform or how we recite or how we behave. Jesus said, you go back one chapter in Matthew to the 11th chapter, come unto me, all you who are weary and burdened. This is Matthew 11:28. Come unto me, all you who are weary and burdened. He does not say, come unto me, all of you who made at least a 70 on your examination. The rest of you have to wait until next year to come unto me. He said, come unto me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. You know what the yoke is? The yoke is two animals walking side by side with a yoke around their neck, a big yoke that's placed on their neck, pulling the cart behind them. And Jesus said, take my yoke. I'll be in the left-hand yoke and you be in the right-hand yoke and learn from me. When I go fast, you go fast. When I go slow, you go slow. If I go to the left, you go to the left. If I go to the right, you go to the right. That's what the yoke of Jesus is. And you stand with him. You are learning by formation. You're learning by discipleship. You're learning by walking with him. Not as he lectures you and tells you what to do, but he walks with you. Give me a teacher who will walk with me. I'm tired of having people stand in front of me and tell me, do this. I want somebody who will say, come with me and take my hand and we'll walk. That's the way you teach your children. You don't teach your children by lining them up against the wall and say, do this. You don't teach your children by telling them to pray. You teach your children by praying for them and by praying with them. It's done through formation, not by the passing of information. Jesus says, take my yoke upon you. Learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart, and you will find rest for your souls. My yoke is easy, my burden is light. He's talking about beasts of burden. He says, the cart you pull behind you is a light cart. The burden, the sacks that I put on your back will not break you down. But you will walk with me and you will learn as you do this. He's teaching us by yoking us with him. Now, what we must do is to relearn. It's difficult for us to relearn because we have learned to judge people on the basis of how they recite and how they perform and whether they keep the Sabbath and many other things. And on the basis of that, we judge them. And God is saying, I don't judge people that way. I don't judge them on their IQ. I don't judge them whether they've got a fancy vocabulary or have no vocabulary. I don't judge them whether they can walk or not walk. I don't judge them whether they're bald or hairy or black or white or single or married or divorced 100 times. I don't judge people on the basis of that. I judge them on the basis of their heart. And it's hard for us to learn to respect people for being people. It's hard for us to learn to respect ourselves. We judge ourselves. We grade ourselves. We judge each other. We grade our wives and our husbands and our children. You grade all of that. You boys grade the girls. You say, well, Bo Derek's a number 10. Ha! Give her 60 years and find out if she's a number 10. God does not grade on the size of your bust. God grades upon the inner part. Doesn't grade whether you have big muscles or little muscles or wavy hair or a mustache or whatever. He looks upon the heart. That's where the judgment takes place, and he's calling upon us to do as he does, to respect people and to respect ourselves. Frederick Speakman wrote a little book some years ago called Love is Something You Do, and then he tells a marvelous little story of a family who goes to a restaurant. Mother and a father and a little kid, little boy. And they sit down at the restaurant table, and the waitress comes over, and she has her little pad, and she's writing down the order, and she makes her notations, and the father orders, and the mother orders, and the waitresses, and she turns to the little fellow, and she says, "Now, young man, what would you like?" And he said, "Oh," he said, I'd like a hot dog, please." And the father says, "No hot dogs." And the mother says, "You know better than to order a hot dog." And then she looks at the waitress and she says, "Bring him chopped salad and Harvard beets and roast beef and a hard roll." And the waitress is standing there, and she turns and looks at the little boy and she says, "And what would you like on your hot dog?" And a little kid, you know, he lights all up like this, and he says, "Ketchup, lots of ketchup, and bring me a glass of milk too." And the waitress says, "Coming up." And she turns and walks away, leaves the family just in stunned silence, you know. Little boy turns and watches her go with love, and then he turns to his mother and his dad who are sitting there, and with awe and appreciation he says, "You know what? She likes me. She thinks I'm real." A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out. I wonder how many parents think their kids are real. How old do you get before you're real? Before you just, "Come on, shut up, sit down." Kids are to be seen, not heard. Come in and do your little performance. Come on, dance a little step. Show us your pinafore. Get on back in the other room. There's a marvelous doctrine in the Bible called the free will of men. The free will of men. We don't hear too much about it. But basically what it is it says God looks upon mankind and says, "It's good. Everything I have created is good, and I will not override your free will. I love you so much that I will not override that. Sure, you've got sin in your life, and you've pushed me out, and you have crucified my son, but I love you." God sees us all, regardless of who we are or what we've done. He sees us all as precious in his sight, and he looks for the spark and blows gently upon it until it comes to fire. Now, salvation is the process of becoming who you really are in God's sight. Starts with conversion, starts with an experience with Jesus Christ. So you have to start it there. But from that time on, it's a process. You see, God had you in mind from the very foundations of the earth, from the very beginning of the earth. He had you in mind from that, whatever that marvelous time is called, the Alpha. whenever that was, you were in God's mind. And he's had a purpose and a plan for you. From that moment on, he's had a purpose and a plan. And now that you're here on earth, you have a lifespan, and some of you have messed it up pretty good, but you've still got time left. There's still breath. And you've got lifespan to fulfill God's purpose for your life. It is never messed up beyond repair. Never. And he will take everything that has happened to you, and he will turn that for good. That's the whole concept of Romans 8:28. That because you are the called according to his purpose, all things work together for good because you love him. And he will take those things and will blow his breath upon it. And fire will come, and there will be warmth, and there will be creativity that will spark from you because God has a purpose for you and for you alone. Now, men don't seem to understand this somehow about themselves or about others, and that's the reason they do crazy things to themselves. It's the reason they do crazy things to others. That's the reason we lock people up in the name of rehabilitation, and it's all a bunch of garbage. We're not locking people up in rehabilitation. We're locking them up out of vengeance or because we don't know what to do with them or to get them out of our hair or whatever else. God does not lock people up for punishment. Now, God does put us aside sometimes to rehabilitate us. But it's all for the purpose of becoming, so we can become who God really intends for us to be. And so we get rid of the person who bothers us. God reaches out to the person who bothers him and says, I see you, black sheep. Come over here. You're precious to me. The problem is that we fail to do as God does. We fail to look at the heart. There's that marvelous story over in 1 Samuel 16 of Samuel going down to Jesse's house, Jesse the shepherd, and saying, God has sent me. God has sent me because he's going to anoint one of your kids as the king of Israel. And as that kid is anointed as the king of Israel, then God one day is going to raise him up. I think that's 1 Samuel 16. Let me just read you what happens there. And remember how the story goes, and all of Jesse's sons, they bring them in from the field, and boy, they're all nice-looking kids, and they're bronzed, and they're healthy, and they're muscular, and they're all number 10s. And then Samuel looks at him, and he says, well, none of these is the right one. He says, are there any more? And he says, well, yeah, there's a run out there in the field. And he doesn't even look like a good Jew. He's got red hair and freckles. And he says, well, I think you better go get him. And he says, the reason you go get him is because God does not consider his appearance or his height. 1 Samuel 16:7, the Lord does not look at the things man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. The Lord looks at the heart. This is kind of birthday season for a lot of folks. We talked about Jimmy's birthday. We had a birthday party yesterday in our home group. Gene Berry, who's the leader of our home group, is having a birthday. Gene's one of the elders here, and he leads our home group. And so the group got together and decided they should give Gene a little party. Gene's going through a very traumatic situation in his life. He's going through the same birthday that I went through 2 years ago, and that's tough to turn 50. All of life just kind of grinds down and stops at 50, and you have to crank it all up again. And so we decided we would help him crank it up again yesterday for a little birthday party. It's not quite his birthday, but we gave it to him ahead of time. And so each one of us, we had a breakfast together and in the home group, and each one of us gave him a gift. And I was kind of interested in the gifts that we gave him. We did it right. We had little candies and balloons and all the things you're supposed to have at birthday parties for 50-year-old men. And then they brought out the gifts, and it was interesting to look at the gifts. The most elegantly wrapped gift was full of gumballs. And the most precious gift was in a brown paper bag. And his wife gave it to him. And it was just a brown paper sack. But when you open it up, inside was a beautiful sculptured gold wedding band with some diamonds in it, which was a gift of great affection from a wife to her husband, not only looking back, but looking forward to the years that they have together. And I thought, you know, how like God. God doesn't look on the wrappings. I'm so grateful he doesn't look on the wrappings. But he looks upon the heart. And we are to look, as I noticed Gene looking yesterday at his wife Jane, not just at the gift, but at the giver. The gift is precious, but the giver is so much more precious than even the gift itself. God does not look on the wrappings of our lives. The outward appearance, our outward behavior, looks upon our heart. Now that's dangerous, because he sees our heart. Today's my wife's birthday. I remember it because it's Jimmy's birthday. And I gave my wife a gift this morning. And I gave her a gift with no wrapping whatsoever. In fact, I gave it to her early this morning when she was standing in the bathroom brushing her teeth, and she didn't have any wrapping on. I had gone through her little jewelry box the other day. I was looking at all the costume jewelry that she's collected across the years. She's kept everything that she's ever gotten, all the way back to the little gold footballs that I gave her when I was in high school. And she had as a necklace made that she could wear. And she's got all that stuff. And I said, is there anything in here that's real? And she said, well, not very much. Most of it's just artificial stuff. You got any real pearls? No, I don't have any real pearls. Everything's artificial. So I said, well, every woman needs a real something. And so I got her some real pearls that she can stick in her ears. And I told her this morning, I said, I want you to have something real because you're real. You're genuine. There's nothing artificial about you. Scares me to death sometimes because I wish she were a little more artificial. But she's, with Jackie, what you see is what you get. And what you get is what you see. I mean, it's just all right out there in front. And if she doesn't like what's going on, she tells you. Told me last night. And I had to fix the shower door after she told me. I have learned some things across the years. I have learned that you don't force love. You can't demand it. It's not, you don't have love through a bunch of rules. You can't set up rules that say, love me. Here are the rules to love. Love is something out of the heart. I didn't force my wife to marry me. I want her to marry me, but I didn't take a gun and say, okay, marry me or else. I could have done that, I guess, but if I'd have done that, then every meal I would have eaten from now on, I would have had to give the first bite to the dog to see if he dropped dead. I don't want to go through life wondering whether the next meal is the last one I'm ever going to eat, you know. We have learned to accept one another. Love has come hard and painful over these 30 years of marriage. It's a process that we work on. And I have learned that you don't form it by breaking the bruised reed or by snuffing out the smoldering wick. Love comes with each other as it comes from God, by treating each other tenderly and gently, and by finding the spark and blowing on it gently, and watching it grow into flame. And that's what he does with our lives. Kind of exciting. That he finds us as dry tinder. But someplace underneath there. There it is. There's a spark. And he blows on it. And there's fire. And there's warmth. And there's creation. And I'm here this morning to tell you that if you'll let him blow on your life, there'll be life.